Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and today we're going to do chapter 57 of The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford. And now we're getting into some discussion of Paul Warburg and the Federal Reserve System that was created. He was the main creator of it. He was a German Jew financier, like all the people we're going to hear about in this chapter. Actually, the two with him will be 58 and 59, which we'll do as a package. But in 57, we're going to hear about some of the background of the main Jewish financiers in the U.S. And the title of this chapter, and you can find all of our recordings at vnnforum.com, is Chapter 57, The Jewish Idea in American Monetary Affairs. So what the Jews have in mind, what type of people they are, is what we're going to hear about in this chapter, which we'll do as a discrete unit. Mr. Brisbane says that Jewish bankers exercise their large measure of control because they are abler than other bankers. It was very good of Mr. Brisbane, or Brisbane is how it's spelled. It's pronounced Brisbane in Australia. It was good of Mr. Brisbane to say so, and it adds to the sum of his weekly, almost daily, worship at the Jewish shrine. But it is scarcely true. Jewish bankers do not yet control the United States, and again, this is written in a series of newspaper articles that these chapters are drawn from that appeared in 1920 and 21 in the Dearborn Independent. So he's talking about a typical Jew shill back then named Mr. Brisbane. Jewish bankers do not yet control the United States, and the principal reason they do not is that they are not abler than other bankers. Doubtless they seek control. Doubtless they have almost grasped it on several occasions, but not yet. Nevertheless, says Henry Ford, they form such a formidable force, and with their international connections constitute such a political problem, that the mere fact of their failing to top the column of control is not so reassuring as it sounds. The great Jewish banking houses of the United States are foreign importations, as perhaps everyone knows. Most of them are sufficiently recent to be considered in their immigrant status, while the thought of them as aliens is stimulated by their retention of overseas connections. It is this international quality of the Jewish banking group which largely accounts for Jewish financial power. There is team play, intimate understandings, and while there is a margin of competition among themselves, as at golf, there is also a wiping out of that margin when it comes to a contest between Jewish and quote-unquote Gentile capital. The Jews work together. There may be some superficial competition between them, but the bottom line is they are working together to control and cartelize the banking industry as all others. Four conspicuous contemporary names in Jewish American finance are Belmont, Schiff, Warburg, and Kahn. Belmont, again, the Jew Schoenberg, representative of Rothschild, or Rothschild. Rothschild in German, red sign, as we're going to hear. All of them, even the most recent, are of foreign origin. Belmont, Schiff, Warburg, and Kahn. August Belmont was the earliest and arrived in America in 1837 as the American representative of the Rothschilds, in whose offices he had been raised. His birthplace was that great center of Jewish international finance, Frankfurt on the Main, Frankfurt am Main, Main River. This is Frankfurt's the financial center of Germany, and London would be the financial center of England. Today, I think it's undoubted London and New York would be the two main financial centers of the world. Frankfurt's still important, but secondary to those. Anyway, so August Belmont comes over in 1837. He's a representative of Lord Rothschild, red sign, shield, right? Red sign on their door in where they lived in Frankfurt in the Jewish quarter. August Belmont became the founder of the Belmont family in America, which has largely forgotten its Jewish origin. Politics was a part of his concern in this country, and during the critical time from 1860 to 1872, he was chairman of the National Democratic Committee. His management of the Rothschild interests was exceedingly profitable to that house, although the operations in which he engaged were quite simple compared with the operations of the present day. So back in the 1860s, 70s versus, you know, 50, 60 years later. Jacob Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, this is the one that Al Gore's family married into, his daughter married into. Jacob Schiff is another Jewish financier who was given to the world by Frankfurt on the Main. He entered the United States in 1865 after having passed his apprenticeship in the office of his father, who was also an agent of the Rothschilds. The name Schiff runs a long way back without change, unlike the name of Rothschild. Originally named Bauer, which is German for peasant or farmer, this family of financiers took a new name from the Red Shield, which adorned their house in the Jewish section of Frankfurt and thus became Rothschild. Rot is the German for red, R-O-T, the Rote Sterne, like the Red Star books. Rothschild, red sign, red shield. Commonly, the last syllable is pronounced as if it were child, that is, if we anglicize it to the Rothschild, it sounds more English, but it's Rothschild in German. So Rothschild, sort of halfway in between. An epoch-making family in itself, it has trained hundreds of agents and apprentices, of whom Jacob H. Schiff was one. Rothschilds, or the Rothschilds, Rothschilds trained Jacob Schiff as they trained hundreds of others. He became one of the principal channels through which German Jewish capital flowed into American undertakings, and his agencies in these matters gave him a place in many important departments of American business, especially in railroads, banks, insurance companies, and telegraph companies. So these would have been some of the main growth areas of the American economy in the post-war period, the post-Civil War period, 1850 to 1900 and beyond. Railroads, banks, insurance companies, and telegraph as they're creating a nation and binding it together with transportation and electronic communications. He married Teresa Loeb, L-O-E-B, and in due time came to be head of the firm Kuhn, Loeb and Company. That's Schiff. Mr. Schiff, too, was interested in politics with a Jewish angle and was perhaps the moving force in the campaign which forced Congress and the President to break off treaty relations with Russia, then a friendly nation, on a strictly Jewish question which had been skillfully given an American aspect. That's a front. Mr. Schiff was of inestimable assistance to Japan in the war against Russia, but is understood to have been disappointed by Japan's shrewdness in preventing too high a return being made for that assistance. So, Schiff is an agent of Rothschild, comes over to the U.S. in 1865, involved with the major growth industries of the time. He aids Japan in their war against Russia. He finances the Bolshevik Revolution. But even before that, he got the U.S. to break a treaty with Russia. We heard about that in an earlier chapter involving Mr. Taft and the way the Jews poison relations between the U.S. and the Russia. So at every point at which he touches American white Aryan interest, he does damage, this Schiff. Associated with Mr. Schiff in Kuhn and Loeb and Company is Otto Hermann Kahn, K-A-H-N, who was probably more international than were either of the two gentlemen mentioned above, Bellman and Schiff, and is more constantly engaged in dabbling in mysterious matters of an international nature. This characteristic may be accounted for, however, by his experience of many countries. He was born in Germany and is also a product of the Frankfurt-on-the-Main School of Finance, having had connection with the Frankfurt Jewish House of Speyer, S-P-E-Y-E-R. So Rothschild and Speyer are two big Frankfurt Jew houses that produce and train people like Schiff and here Otto Hermann Kahn. Schiff and Kahn come from Rothschild and Speyer, both in Frankfurt. Frankfurt Jew money. And remember, when we abrogated the treaty with Russia that was in American and Russian interest, Subsequently, all Russian trade was handled through these Frankfurt Jew houses, to the detriment of both Americans and Russians. Of just how many countries Mr. Khan has been a citizen is a question not easy to determine here because of the doubt that was recently cast upon his American citizenship by a protest against his being permitted to cast his vote last year, and by his failure, the announced cause being physical indisposition, to cast his vote. If Mr. Khan is a citizen of the United States, a status that will be readily proclaimed upon proof that he is, that probably increases the number of his citizenships to 3. Not just a dual national, but possibly a tri-national. He was a German citizen by birth and served in the German army, and in 1914, in August, at the time of the outbreak of the European War, when efforts were being made, which afterwards succeeded, to put Paul M. Warburg, a member of the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company, on the Federal Reserve Board, Mr. Warburg testified that at that time, Mr. Khan was not a citizen of the United States. And now we're going to have some, I suppose, Senate transcripts go fairly extensive discussing all this, the citizenship of Mr. Khan. Senator Bristow, how many of these partners are American citizens, or are they all American citizens? Mr. Warburg, Paul Warburg. They are all American citizens except Mr. Khan. Page 7, Senate hearings, August 1, 1914. Senator Bristow, now, the members of your firm, are they all American citizens except Mr. Khan? Except Mr. Khan, yes. Was Mr. Khan ever an American citizen? Warburg, no. Bristow, he never was? Warburg, no, he's a British subject. The chairman, he lives in England, does he not? Mr. Warburg, no. At one time he thought he would move to Europe, and that was when the question arose of his standing for Parliament. Then he changed his mind and moved back to the United States. This is how fluid, you talk about gender fluid, these are citizen fluid Jews. They move around the world, they're truly an international race. Wherever the prospects are best, or wherever they need to be, that's what they suddenly become. Just as they shift between race and religion, so they shift among nationalities and citizenships. Or they even literally change their name. And the Goyim are fooled because the Goyim are suckers and cattle, and they take appearances for reality. And they take words for actions, as we heard when we discussed the protocols. Mr. Warburg, no, he was not. But there was talk about it. It had been suggested, and he had it in mind. Something had been written about it in the papers. That's him moving to England and becoming a member of Parliament, or running for Parliament. Back to Ford again. So, that if Mr. Khan is a citizen of the United States now, which as a matter of fact has been disputed, then he has been a citizen of 3 countries, Germany and Great Britain being the other 2. Mr. Khan, by the way, is one of those Jews whose adoption of another form of faith brings no denunciation whatever from the Jews themselves. A most peculiar circumstance, because we've heard in other chapters how they can't stand Jews who convert. But if it's merely a cover name or cover religion, they don't care. But doubtless not inexplicable. Mr. Khan is not called a renegade Jew, quote-unquote, nor any of the other nasty names heaped upon Jewish converts to Christianity, because he does not deserve them. They would not fit him. He is not a renegade, and he never was regarded for a moment by Jacob H. Schiff as anything else but a Jew. Else that Prince of Israel, quote-unquote, would not have chosen him to remain in America and run the business of Kuhn Loeb & Company at a time when it seemed undesirable to put the junior Schiff in full charge of it. Doubtless it was Mr. Khan's desire, just at the time Jacob Schiff made his wishes known, to go to England and stand for Parliament. But from New York he fulfills, probably as well as he could from London, those mysterious missions which frequently take him to the continent, at which times he makes what are regarded as certain authoritative decisions, though just whose decisions it is not always possible to say. In Paris particularly, and at points east thereof, toward Russia, Mr. Khan has been established in the position of spokesman of the American financial hierarchy, which, of course, he is not. But he undoubtedly is the spokesman of some group possibly the group that so ably put through the Jewish program at the Peace Conference, Versailles, the group that impressed Eastern Europe with the feeling that the United States of America was a very powerful Semitic empire. Remember that earlier chapter, complaints from Poland and Romania that the U.S. is run by Jews and they're doing bitterly anti-Polish, anti-Aryan, Goy national groups in the name of America. Mr. Kahn's trips abroad are usually unheralded, but their results richly repay observation. A fourth member of the Jewish financial group in America, which is the form of statement which Mr. Chaim Weizmann would sanction, rather than to say Jewish American financiers, he'd prefer them say the Jewish financial group in America, is Mr. Paul Warburg, to whose testimony we have just alluded. Mr. Warburg is the most recent of all. He was born in Germany in 1868. He came to the United States in 1902. He became an American citizen in 1911. He came to the U.S. for the express purpose of reforming our financial system, and it is hardly possible to understand fully the system in operation today without reference to Paul Warburg. He is a man of very fine mind, a moneymaker, but something more, a shrewd system, a shrewd student of the systems by which money is made. There are two types engaged in the mere work of money making, which is better described as money getting, quote unquote, without reference to production. One type grubs away under whatever system obtains, regarding it as fixed as the solar system. Another type is sufficiently detached to see the system as an artifice that may be mended, remodeled, or supplanted altogether. Paul Warburg, scion of a long line of German Jewish bankers, is of the latter type. He is not content with the fact that the cash register fills itself with money. He wants also to know how the cash register works and whether it can be worked. He is thus a student of money and of the number of ways in which it can be manipulated. Perhaps it will be best to let him tell his own story as far as it goes. When he told it to the Committee on Banking and Currency of the United States Senate in executive session, there was some dispute as to whether the proceeding should be recorded by stenographer. It was finally agreed that notes should be made but should not be divulged. The testimony was printed, quote, in confidence, quote, on August 5, 1914, and nominally made public on August 12th. The Warburgs are one of the international families whose importance was not realized until the war, and would not have been realized then if their internationalism had not been so apparent. It was an interesting spectacle to see brothers occupying important places of counsel on either side of the great struggle. Paul Warburg learned the rudiments of banking in his father's bank at Hamburg, Germany. So the Schiffs and the Kahn, Schiff and Kahn came out of Frankfurt, both Jews. Rothschild and Speyer House, and then Warburg comes out of his own Warburg father's firm out of Hamburg. So Frankfurt, Hamburg, all these are German Jews controlling the money in the U.S., seeing an antiquated system and setting up the Federal Reserve in response so that they have a Jewish private monopoly cartel over money that is the full faith and support of the U.S. government so that they can effectively counterfeit money legally and supply one of the pincers of the anvil, or the pincers. The other pincer being progressive taxation, and through counterfeiting they can grind away the middle class and enrich these already super-rich bankers. That was the first step, setting up the Federal Reserve. Paul Warburg learned the rudiments of banking in his father's bank at Hamburg, Germany, studying the overseas trade that is the foundation of that city's business. The banking houses of Warburg in Hamburg dates from 1796. So it's about 100 years old when all this is starting to go on, 110 years old, 115 years old. After that, this is a quote now from transcript from the Senate hearings. After that, I went to England, where I stayed for 2 years, first in the banking and discount firm of Samuel Montague and Company. Montague is a common name taken by Jews, an Anglo name adopted by Jews as a cover name. And after that, I took the opportunity of staying 2 months in the office of a stockbroker in order to learn that part of the business. After that, I went to France, where I stayed in a French bank so that the chairman. What French bank was that? Warburg, it was the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade, which has an agency in Paris. And after that, I went back to Hamburg and worked there again for a year, I think. Then I went around to India, China, and Japan. So what an incredibly comprehensive financial and cultural education this Jew has. So they're almost uniquely positioned to be able to understand what's going on at a global level, let alone finance it. They're very much in position to pull the strings. And then I came to this country for the first time in 1893. I stayed here only a short time then and went back to Hamburg and then became a partner of the firm in Hamburg. The chairman, how long were you in Hamburg then in the banking business? Mr. Warburg, until 1902. So then after all this, he spent a decade there at Hamburg. And then I moved over here to this country to become a partner of Kuhn Loeb & Company. I explained in the curriculum which I gave you, Mr. Chairman, that by marriage I am related to the members of the firm, the late Mr. Loeb having been my father-in-law, he married Teresa Loeb, which brought about a desire on the part of the family to bring me over here. I ought to say that I got married in this country in 1895, and that I have been in this country every year since for several months, so he's splitting his time between Hamburg and the U.S. That is the history of my banking education. Conclude that portion of the transcript. It will be recalled that Jacob H. Schiff also married a daughter of Mr. Loeb, so that Mr. Warburg married the sister of Mrs. Jacob H. Schiff. So both Schiff and Warburg are married to Loeb. All these people are Jews, and they're all financially related as well as related by marriage. Felix Warburg, Paul's brother, who was also in the firm, married Mr. Schiff's daughter. So there's another Warburg-Loeb connection, as well as the Schiff-Loeb connection. Mr. Warburg immediately cast a critical eye upon the state of financial affairs in the United States, and it is significant of the grasp he already had on such matters that he found the country rather behind the times. He conceived the ambition, the very daring ambition, of taking hold of the United States monetary system and making it what he thought it ought to be. This alone would make him a remarkable man. It illustrates very well that detached point of view which the Jew is more fitted to take than perhaps any other man. He sees countries and systems with the same freedom from intimate bias with which another man would view assorted fish upon a market stall. The Jew has sort of an eagle-eye view of the whole thing, whereas the whites are engaged in the actual business and actual production at the street level. Most of the world is engaged in doing its work and indulging its national, racial, domestic, and social affections and inclinations. A small minority stands in the background and watches the entire mass at its unconscious maneuvers and studies it as an observer studies a hive of bees. The man at work has no time except for his job. One man, standing back and studying 1,000 men at work, is able to see how he might utilize their labor or possess himself of a first toll on their production. Doubtless there must be men to stand at a sufficient distance from things to get a correct idea of their interrelationship, and doubtless such an attitude may be made of great service to the race, but doubtless it has also contributed to the selfish manipulation of natural and social processes. Mr. Warburg testified, quote, when I came here, I was at once impressed by the lack of system, by the old-fashioned nature of the system that prevailed here. And I got immediately into one of those periods of high interest rates where call money went up 25% and 100%. And I wrote an article on the subject then and there for my own benefit. Quote, I was not here 3 weeks before I was trying to explain to myself the roots of the evil. I showed the article to a few friends, but I kept it in my desk because I did not want to be one of those who try to inform and educate the country after they have been here for a month or so. And I kept that article until the end of 1906, shortly before the panic, when those conditions arose again, and when one newspaper wanted for an issue at the end of the year an article dealing with the conditions in our country. Then I took that article and touched it up and brought it up to date. And that was the first article of mine that was published. It was called Defects and Needs of Our Banking System by Paul Warburg. That was, however, the first time that I know of that the question of the discount system and the concentration of reserves was really brought out. And I got a great many encouraging letters asking me to go on and explain my ideas. Ford. Mr. Warburg was perfectly willing to talk to the committee about himself, but not about Kuhn Loeb and Company, his firm. Quote, I cannot discuss the affairs of my firm nor my partners, he said, nor be asked to criticize acts of my partners, either to approve them or in any other way. But eventually he did tell a number of things which students of American financial affairs have considered interesting, of which more later. On page 77 of the testimony, more personal matters appear. Bristow, when did you become a citizen of the United States, Mr. Warburg? Warburg, 1911. Did I not answer that? Bristow, perhaps so. Did you intend to become a citizen when you came to the United States in 1902? Warburg, I had no definite intentions then, because of some of the reasons that brought me over here were family reasons. That had a good deal to do with my first coming here, and I was not at all sure that I would stay here when I came. When did you decide to become a citizen of the United States? In 1908, when I took out my papers. When you took out your first papers? You took out your second papers then in 1911. Yes, says Warburg. Bristow, you made your declaration in 1908. That is when you decided to become an American citizen. Yes, says Warburg. Why did you wait as long as you did after you came to this country before deciding to become a citizen of this country? Warburg, I think that a man does not come here as an immigrant, a man who has had, if you may call it such, a prominent position in his own country, will not give up his nationality so easily as a man who comes over here knowing that he does not care for his own country at all. I had been a very loyal citizen of my own country, and I think that a man who hesitates in giving up his own nationality and taking a new one is apt to be more loyal to his new country when he does not change his nationality, when he does change his nationality, than a man who gives up his old country more lightly. Senator Bristow, yes. Mr. Warburg, I may add this, that a thing which had a great deal of influence on my making up my mind to remain in this country and work here and become a part and parcel of this country was that monetary reform work, for I felt I had a distinct duty to perform here, and I thought I could do that. And in fact, I have been working on it since 1906 or 1907. This is the Fed, which comes to be in, I think, 1913, or right around this time, 1912, into 1913. Quote, then I felt that it was the right thing for me to do, to become an American citizen and work here and throw in my lot definitely with this country. Bristow, when you became an American citizen, and the motive which induced you to become an American citizen was then, as I understand it, largely with a view of laboring to bring about a reform of the American monetary system. Mr. Warburg, well, you put it nearly exclusively on that. I think a man wants to feel that he is going to do some useful work in his country, that he has a mission to perform, and that is what happened to me. Moreover, I had been long enough in this country then to have thoroughly taken root and feel that I was part and parcel of it. Bristow, yes. When did you first become active in promoting the monetary reforms in the United States? Mr. Warburg, 1906. Senator Bristow, what was your method of promoting your ideas with regard to monetary reforms? Mainly writing. Were you connected with the Monetary Commission? No, not directly. Were you consulted in regard to the report of the Monetary Commission in any way? Yes, Senator Aldrich consulted with me about the details, and I gave him my advice freely. And in regard to the bill which was prepared by Senator Aldrich in connection with the commission, were you consulted in regard to that? Yes, says Warburg. What part did you have in the preparation of that bill, directly or indirectly? Mr. Warburg, well, only that I gave the best advice that I could give. That's the end of that section of the transcript of the hearings from back then. Most readers, says Ford, will recall that the name of Aldrich, A-L-D-R-I-C-H, was, a few years ago, the synonym for the money power in government. Senator Aldrich was an able man and a tireless worker. His character for thoroughness and industry did more than anything else to disabuse the popular mind of the notion that such men were mere, quote, tools of the money interest, unquote, or engaged in their work out of a lust for gain or out of sheer pleasure in legislating against the interests of the people. Senator Aldrich led on tariff and financial matters because he understood them, and he understood them by tireless study of them, and therefore he was the master of other men who had not paid the price of knowledge. But he understood these matters from the standpoint of the business interests only. He was sincerely desirous of the prosperity of the country, but that prosperity was written in banking balances. 15 years ago, it might not have been possible to judge him thus calmly, because he represented in the public mind, more than any individual does today, the concentrated power of the financial group. Their prosperity was his first care, possibly because he believed that their prosperity was also the country's. And remember the statement, what's good for GM is good for America. So, this may have been an honest banker. He did the work necessary to understand these matters, and he thought that the good, solid, profitable banking would be good for the U.S., is what Ford seems to be saying, in contradistinction to these Jews who are manipulating it for other purposes, such as expressing the protocols, although he doesn't get into that at this point. It was such a man, then, that came to Mr. Warburg for advice. The labors of Senator Aldrich comprise many volumes of difficult material, and Senator Aldrich's appeal to Mr. Warburg was a very high compliment to the quality of the latter's mind and financial experience. This, of course, assuming that Mr. Warburg's counsel was not forced upon the Aldrich Committee by the New York money interests. In his testimony, Mr. Warburg did not tell all. The omission, however, was supplied by an article in Leslie's Weekly magazine, in italics, in 1916, the author being B.C. Forbes. It is a story of which Current Opinion, I guess another magazine or newspaper, said, it reads like the opening in a shilling shocker. It appears that the conferences between Mr. Warburg and Senator Aldrich took place on an isolated island off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island. And this is written about in a book by Edward Griffin, let me look that up. I don't want to get it wrong. Yes, it's The Creature of Jekyll Island, which is the long, involved story of the creation of, it's in the entire history of money, and then culminating in the understanding of the Federal Reserve and what it means. If you want to read a book about all this, that is the book to read, by G. Edward Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And we should do that as an audiobook one of these days. Now, let's see. It appears that the conferences, so Warburg doesn't really give the full flavor of his advising Aldrich, the number one, I guess, goyish money man in the U.S. Senate, the one who understands it compared to the rest. Why, he takes him and some others down to Georgia, sight unseen, in a railroad car, and they go off onto this coastal island, totally private, so the media can't follow them, in order to redo the American financial system and turn white Americans like you listening to this into slaves. So that you're working, if not for free, you're making them money against your own will. It appears that the conferences between Mr. Warburg and Senator Aldrich took place on an isolated island off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island. Like Jekyll and Hyde. Included in the party, besides Senator Aldrich and Mr. Warburg, were two New York bankers and the then Assistant Treasurer of the United States. The mysteriousness of it all was well brought out by Mr. Forbes, writing in Leslie's Weekly. Mr. Forbes. Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York on a private railroad car under cover of darkness, stealthily hieing hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking out to an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such rigid secrecy that the name of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servitors learn their identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret episode in the history of American finance. The utmost secrecy was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done. Senator Aldrich notified each one to go quietly into a private car, which the railroad had received orders to draw up at an unfrequented platform. So one by one they slip onto this. It's like a heist movie, you know. To draw up in a, one by one they get into this private car, and then they all zoom down to Georgia quietly, and no one knows what's going on. Drawn blinds balked any peering eyes that might be around. Off the party set. New York's ubiquitous reporters had been foiled. So far, so good. After bowling along the railroad hour after hour into southern country, the order was given to prepare to disembark. Stepping from the car when the station had been well cleared of travelers, the members of the expedition embarked in a small boat. Silence reigned, for the boatmen must not find out how distinguished were their passengers. In due time, they drew up at another deserted pier. They were at Jekyll Island, off Georgia. The island was entirely unpeopled, save for a half a dozen servants. The servants must under no circumstances learn who we are, cautioned Senator Aldrich. What can we do to fool them? Asked another member of the group. The problem was discussed. I have it, cried one. Let's all call each other by our first names. Don't ever let us mention our last names. It was so agreed. The dignified veteran Senator Aldrich, King of Rhode Island, and a power second to none in the United States Senate, became just Nelson. And the quiet, scholarly member of the powerful international banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company became Paul. Paul and Nelson, doing some banking. Nelson had meanwhile confided to Harry, Frank, Paul, and Piat that he was to keep them locked up on Jekyll Island, cut off from the rest of the world, until they had evolved and compiled a scientific currency system for the United States, a system that would embody all that was best in Europe, yet so modeled that it could serve a country measuring hundreds, measuring thousands, where European countries measured only hundreds of miles. So they're going to create a financial system based on this is the best practices from Europe, and it's going to serve an entire continent that is the U.S., rather than just a few hundred miles. But whose best interests are served by this? Well, the answer is the Jews. Mr. Forbes does not omit to write this further description of Mr. Warburg's condition at the time. Quote, unable then to speak idiomatic English with perfect freedom and without an accent, an alien not naturalized. Mr. Forbes also wrote, here is a German-American, but the sort of one that makes the hyphen look like a badge of honor. That was in 1916. Hyphens went out of fashion, though not entirely out of use, soon after. You may remember the 100% Americans, Anglos, who were very viciously anti-Americans of German descent and really persecuted them. That's something you don't ever hear about nowadays, but that's a side note anyway. We're talking about financial stuff. Thus far, the story of Paul Warburg. And we'll leave it there. That was in the Dearborn Independent in 18 June 1921. But we're just getting into the story. And we'll have in the next, we'll have the two chapters, the full story of Jekyll Island and the system that Paul Warburg created coming up. So thanks for listening to me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.